From New York, this is Democracy Now!
What I'm doing is enabling all qualified Americans to serve their country in uniform and restoring the situation that existed before with transgender personnel, if qualified in every other way, can serve their government in the United States military.
President Biden reverses the Trump administration's ban on transgender people serving in the military. But trans rights are under attack in Montana, the Dakotas, and other states. We'll speak to the ACLU's Chase Strangio. Then, as Biden proposes a pathway to citizenship for 11 million undocumented immigrants, what should Biden do about the record number of people deported during the Obama-Biden years?
If President Biden is serious about restoring humanity to the immigration system, he can't just reverse Donald Trump's policies. He must actually work to repair the harm that was done when he was vice president, when record high deportations under the Obama administration left immigrant communities across the United States fractured and financially devastated.
Then, as the wealth of U.S. billionaires soars by over $1 billion during the pandemic, Oxfam is warning COVID-19 could lead to the biggest increase in global inequality on record. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. House impeachment managers have delivered an article of impeachment to the Senate, charging Donald J. Trump with incitement of insurrection. On Monday evening, the 9 impeachment managers walked the article through National Statuary Hall and the Capitol Rotunda to the Senate, where on January 6, a violent mob incited by President Trump attacked police officers, looted lawmakers' offices, and delayed the certification of Joe Biden's Electoral College victory. The violence left 5 people dead. Maryland Congressmember Jamie Raskin, who'll lead the prosecution against Trump, read the article of impeachment to the Senate.
Donald John Trump thus warrants impeachment and trial, removal from office, and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States.
Senate President Pro Tem Patrick Leahy, the Vermont Democrat, will preside over Trump's impeachment trial, not John Roberts, the Supreme Court's Chief Justice. The trial is set to begin on February 9th. The Justice Department's Inspector General has announced plans to investigate whether any current or former officials at the Justice Department worked with President Trump in his failed attempt to overturn the 2020 election. This comes just days after the New York Times revealed Trump considered replacing Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen with another DOJ official, Jeffrey Clark, who embraced Trump's conspiracy theories about the election. In related news, Dominion Voting Systems has sued Trump's lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani, for $1.3 billion, accusing the former New York mayor of manufacturing and disseminating conspiracy theories about the company's voting machines. President Joe Biden said Monday his administration would increase its COVID-19 vaccination goal from 100 million shots in the first 100 days to 150 million shots. That's enough to vaccinate 75 million people, a little less than a quarter of the U.S. population. Here in New York, health officials have delayed opening COVID-19 mass vaccination sites at the Yankees and Mets baseball stadiums and on Staten Island due to vaccine shortages. In California, Governor Gavin Newsom has lifted strict stay-at-home orders put in place in December. California's coronavirus cases are down from a massive surge over the holidays, but the state is still reporting over 25,000 new cases per day, and many intensive care units are near capacity. Another 1,800 U.S. residents died of COVID-19 on Monday, pushing the U.S. death toll past 421,000. President Biden's chief medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said Monday that under President Trump, efforts to slow the spread of coronavirus were devastated by anti-mask and anti-social distancing rhetoric.
When public health issues become politically charged, like wearing a mask or not becomes a political statement, it is, you cannot imagine how destructive that is to any unified public health message.
In more vaccine news, Moderna said Monday its COVID-19 vaccine is effective at preventing disease in people infected with new variants of coronavirus. But Moderna warned the vaccine appears to be less potent against one variant first discovered in South Africa. Moderna says it's working on a modified booster shot in case it's needed to combat the South African variant or other lineages that might evolve further resistance to human immune responses. Meanwhile, drug maker Merck has abandoned research into COVID-19 vaccines after two of its candidates failed to provoke a strong immune response in patients enrolled in a clinical trial. On Capitol Hill, Senator Mitch McConnell has dropped his demand that Democrats promise to preserve the filibuster, ending a standoff over a power-sharing deal between the two parties over how to run the divided chamber. McConnell made the announcement after two Democrats, West Virginia's Joe Manchin and Arizona's Kyrsten Sinema, expressed opposition to getting rid of the filibuster, which has been used over the years to uphold slavery and fight against civil rights legislation. President Biden has signed an executive order repealing the Trump administration's ban on transgender people serving in the military. Biden also ordered the Pentagon to review the files of troops who were forced out because of the ban and to immediately halt discharges of transgender troops now serving. Lieutenant Colonel Bree Fram, vice president of the transgender military advocacy group Sparta, welcomed the news.
We believe with 4 or 8 more years of open service, looking back, you'll see a military without transgender people just as unconscionable as one would be without other minorities that are serving today.
Puerto Rico's governor has declared a state of emergency over gender-based violence following at least 60 incidents of femicide reported in 2020. 6 of the murders were of trans women. Meanwhile, right-wing state lawmakers in Montana, North Dakota, and South Dakota are pushing a number of new anti-trans bills. We'll have more on the fight over trans rights after headlines with the ACLU's Chase Strangio. The Senate has voted to confirm Janet Yellen to be Treasury Secretary, making her the first woman to ever hold the post. During her confirmation hearing, the former Federal Reserve Chair urged lawmakers to act big on the next COVID-19 relief package.
The smartest thing we can do is act big. In the long run, I believe the benefits will far outweigh the costs, especially if we care about helping people who have been struggling for a very long time.
The Senate's also expected to confirm Tony Blinken to be Secretary of State today after he received the support of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on Monday. During his confirmation hearing, Blinken backed the Trump administration's hardline approach on China and Venezuela, including recognizing opposition leader Juan Guaido as Venezuela's president. Blinken also said the U.S. would move to end its support of the Saudi-led war in Yemen. During the Obama administration, Blinken traveled to Saudi Arabia to expedite weapons delivery shortly after Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen began in 2015. In Yemen, tens of thousands of protesters marched in the capital Sana'a on Monday, condemning former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's designation of Houthi rebels as a terrorist organization. Aid groups warn the designation will only exacerbate Yemen's humanitarian crisis, already the worst in the world, with millions facing famine. In Ontario, Canada, anti-war activists held a nonviolent civil disobedience protest Monday, sitting in the path of trucks carrying armored vehicles bound for Saudi Arabia, who is part of a global day of action against the war in Yemen. This is Rachel Small, an organizer with the group World Beyond Wars.
We're here today demanding that Canada cancel its arms trade to Saudi Arabia, that companies such as Paddock Transport International, who ships the arms, GDLS, who produces the tanks, we're demanding that they immediately stop being complicit in arming Saudi Arabia, in sending weapons to the worst humanitarian situation on the planet.
In Ethiopia, jarring witness accounts are emerging of the involvement of Eritrean soldiers in the deadly conflict in the northern Tigray region. Survivors told the Associated Press that Eritrean troops looted homes and broke into houses searching for and killing Tigrayan men and boys. They're also accused of targeting thousands of refugees and sexually assaulting people. Thousands of Eritrean soldiers have fought on the side of Ethiopian armed forces in the bloody conflict that started in November. Humanitarian aid workers warned earlier this month that hundreds of thousands of people in the Tigray region could starve to death as shops were depleted of food weeks ago and nearly all the region's population, some 4.5 million people, need emergency food aid. In climate news, a satellite survey by British researchers finds Earth's ice sheet lost 28 trillion metric tons of ice between 1994 and 2017 due to global heating from human activity. That's enough to cover the state of Michigan with a sheet of ice 100 meters thick. This comes as the White House is preparing to announce several executive actions Wednesday meant to mitigate the climate crisis, including a ban on some new oil and gas leases on federal land. On Monday, U.S. Climate Ambassador John Kerry told world leaders at the United Nations Climate Adaptation Summit he's proud the U.S. had rejoined the Paris Climate Agreement. Former U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon welcomed the news.
This means the multilateralism, which has been in disarray during the last 4 years, is now back.
The International Labor Organization warns wages fell by $3.7 trillion in 2020, with the coronavirus pandemic eliminating the equivalent of more than a quarter billion full-time jobs. Job losses around the world were four times worse last year than during the global financial crisis that began in 2007. This comes as the International Chamber of Commerce is warning vaccine nationalism could cost the global economy $9.2 trillion if governments fail to provide poorer nations with access to COVID-19 vaccines. Nearly half the losses would impact wealthier countries. We'll have more on the growing economic inequality during the pandemic later in the broadcast. At least three dozen Congress members are appealing to President Biden to commute the sentences of the 50 people on federal death row. In a letter spearheaded by Congress members Cori Bush and Ayanna Pressley, the lawmakers write, quote, "The legacy President Trump left behind is one of carnage and unrestrained violence that must be rectified immediately," unquote. Biden vowed during his campaign to end capital punishment. Congressmember Pressley and Senator Dick Durbin have also introduced a bill to ban the federal death penalty. In media news, the New York Times is facing mounting criticism for firing editor and award-winning journalist Lauren Wolf, allegedly after Wolf tweeted she had chills while watching President Biden's plane land at Joint Base Andrews on the eve of his inauguration. The New York Times has disputed this, saying Wolf was a freelancer and not a full-time employee and that she wasn't laid off over a single tweet. But the paper offered no other explanation for its decision to terminate Wolf. Journalists from across the country condemned Wolf's firing. Author Jillian York wrote on Twitter, quote, "The fact that Tom Friedman can spout absolute warmongering nonsense about the Middle East for decades, but New York Times fires Lauren Wolf over a single tweet tells you everything you need to know about the New York Times," unquote. President Biden's revived efforts to place abolitionist Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill. The plan was announced by the Obama administration in 2016, but was delayed until 2028 by President Trump, citing technical issues. Tubman would be the first black woman to be placed on U.S. currency, replacing former President Andrew Jackson, who enslaved over 100 people. The move was met with mixed responses as racial justice advocates on social media argued the U.S. government should prioritize economic justice for the black community. Screenwriter Kashana Cawley tweeted, "Unfortunately, due to the black women pay gap, if we put Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill, it's only worth $12.20. And the American Library Association has awarded a Caldecott Medal to the children's picture book, We Are Water Protectors, marking the first time in history Indigenous people are recognized with the award. The book was illustrated by Kungit artist Michaela Goad and written by Carol Lindstrom of the Turtle Mountain Band of Ojibwe. The book tells the story of a young woman resisting the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, President Biden has signed an executive order repealing the Trump administration's ban on transgender people serving in the U.S. military. Biden also ordered the Pentagon to review the files of troops who were forced out because of the ban and to immediately halt discharges of transgender troops now serving. On Monday, Biden spoke about the issue as he signed the executive order.
What I'm doing is enabling all qualified Americans to serve their country in uniform and essentially restoring the situation that existed before where transgender personnel, if qualified in every other way, can serve their government in the United States military.
Newly sworn in Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin expressed support for lifting the trans ban during his confirmation hearing last week.
I support the president's plan to overturn the ban. I truly believe, Senator, that, as I said in my opening statement, that if you are fit and you're qualified to serve and you can maintain the standards, you should be allowed to serve. And you can expect that that I will support that throughout.
On his first day in office, President Biden also signed an executive order to extend federal non-discrimination protections to LGBTQ people. And Biden has tapped Dr. Rachel Levine, Pennsylvania's top health official, to be Assistant Secretary of Health. Levine appears poised to become the first openly transgender official to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate. As LGBTQ groups praise Biden's actions in his first week in office, right-wing lawmakers in Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, and other states are pushing a number of new anti-trans bills. On Monday, the Montana House passed a bill banning trans student athletes from participating in school sports and another bill to limit health care options for trans youth. Meanwhile, Puerto Rico's governor has declared a state of emergency over gender-based violence following at least 60 incidents of femicide reported in 2020. Six of the murders were of trans women. To talk more about all of this, we're joined by Chase Strangio, Deputy Director for Transgender Justice with the ACLU's LGBT and HIV Project. Chase, welcome back to Democracy Now! Let's start off with this executive order of President Biden. Can you talk about its significance?
Yeah, thanks, Amy. Thanks, Juan. Good to be back. So, you know, if we go back in time to the beginning of the Trump administration, some of the very first things that he did was to target transgender people, first in schools. And then, if we recall, in July of 2017, by tweet, he decided to ban open trans service in the U.S. military. So finally, after years of litigation, after trans service members being in this precarious position, Biden and Secretary of Defense Austin yesterday lift the ban on open trans service, allowing any qualified individual who is transgender to continue serving in the military and directing the Department of Defense and the Department of Homeland Security to implement a process whereby not only trans people can remain in the military, but can enlist and then also ensure that trans people are able to access health care while serving in the military and that anyone can have their records marking their gender updated to accurately reflect who they are. So this is obviously an incredibly important development, one of the most aggressive examples of de jure discrimination against trans individuals by the Trump administration is now gone.
Well, Chase, for those who see the military as a career, This issue of executive orders basically determining whether trans people can serve is basically it could go back and forth. What are the prospects for some kind of congressional decision on this issue so that we don't have to depend on each on the whims or the viewpoints of a particular administration?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good question. I think in many ways, over the past 10 years and more, really, we've seen, because of the failure of Congress to act in so many ways, the power of the executive expands substantially, and so much being done by executive order and directives to federal executive agencies. I do think when it comes to the issue of open trans service, you know, if we recall, even under Obama, there was a ban on open trans service. It didn't get changed until the end of the second Obama term in 2016, but after years of review. I think what we're going to end up seeing is that after 4 or 8 years of open trans service, that it is going to just be something that we accept as a matter of course, whether or not Congress acts. Because the reality is that trans people have been serving in the military for decades. And the question is, are we going to let them serve openly and proudly, or are we going to force them into the shadows as the Trump administration had done? But the reality is I do think this is going to be relatively uncontroversial over time, because we already have tens of thousands of trans service members and hundreds of thousands of trans veterans. And so I think, you know, this is an important step in taking away some of the most explicit forms of discrimination that we had seen under the Trump administration. And I think one important thing to note is that it really wasn't about the military. I mean, this was announced by tweet. Defense Secretary Mattis, who was defense secretary at the time, really had no idea that this was going to happen. And this was part of a larger project to expel trans people from public life, to enact discriminatory measures. And so that's really the battle that we're fighting against, not only at the federal level, but of course, you know, in many ways across the country. So whether or not Congress acts, I do think once we have sort of policy implementations from the federal agencies, the Defense Department and the Department of Homeland Security, I do think that, you know, we're going to see open trans service, and that after 8-10 years, it's going to be something that we accept as a general matter.
I want to turn to trans activist and author Dean Spade, who was speaking on Democracy Now! After then-President Trump banned transgender people from military service.
When we lose our critique of militarism and of the U.S. military in this debate, what happens, in my view, is that trans people become sort of a symbolic space in which to have basically pro-military advocacy and PR. And so to me, the military inclusion campaign, both for lesbians and gays and for trans people, has often fallen into that trap, only representing the military as a great place to work that does wonderful things to protect our country, which is not, I think, a progressive view. And it rebrands the military as a site of liberation and progressive politics, which it's fundamentally not. The U.S. military, right, is, you know, one of the largest sources of violence on the planet Earth.
Chase Strangio, can you respond to Dean Spade?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, I don't think that, at least from my perspective, I'm hailing this as liberatory, as a progressive intervention, in the same way that I look at formal equality as sort of an incredibly constrained and limited, you know, part of the path towards true justice. I also think we have to keep in mind that while we may critique and should the larger project of U.S. militarism and the U.S. military, it remains the largest employer in the United States. And what the ban did was take away the employment benefits that people had worked decades for, their ability to support themselves and their families. And this was really about taking away people's autonomy, taking away people's autonomy over their labor. And so while I share Dean's larger critique of U.S. militarism, I think that, it, you know, as we abolish and destabilize these harmful institutions that are wreaking havoc across the globe, that we can't do so at the expense of the lives and well-being of individuals, many of whom are coerced because of systemic racism and poverty into the institutions themselves. So from my perspective, this is a critical moment in ending, you know, de jure discrimination, revaluing the labor and bodies of people who have been working incredibly hard and were relying on benefits that, for better or worse, that we coerce people into receiving in many ways. And as someone who, you know, I hold a very, you know, significant critique of U.S. militarism and the Defense Department budget, and also come from a military family. And so while, yes, I don't want our military enacting violence abroad as it inherently does, when my family member is deployed, I also want them to be safe. And that inevitably means investing some amount of resources into a system that I despise. And so I think we have to hold the complexity of that truth. It's not just so simple as we can allow the government to ban a group of people from problematic institutions. We have to recognize that, we are supporting individuals while we are fighting against systems. And I think this is an important moment, not only for trans service members, but for building trans justice, not because the military is a site of liberation, but because de jure discrimination by the government is an impediment to organizing and survival of our communities.
And Chase, could you talk about the various bills that are now at the state level, the anti-trans bills, some of which are being voted on this week?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the, saddest things for me right now is that, we had this change in administration, and the Biden, administration on day one, on the day of inauguration, it issues this relatively innocuous executive order, essentially saying, I'm going to follow federal law. Federal law prohibits sex discrimination. The Supreme Court has already said that means you can't discriminate against LGBTQ people. And yet we have this significant backlash to the very notion that transhumanity is going to be recognized. And one way that is manifesting are in dozens of bills across the country that would ban trans young people from sports and criminalize health care for trans youth. And so at a time when we're facing, epidemics of homelessness, a global pandemic, so many kids aren't in school, they're learning on Zoom, they're not able to participate in sports, we're having states take aim at the bodies of trans young people and telling them that not only should they be excluded from the activities that their peers are participating in, but that the healthcare that they're relying on is about to become a crime. Yesterday, I spent 3 hours listening to floor debates in Montana and just hearing the most horrible things about trans people that are directed at young people by their government. The long-term cost of the introduction of these bills alone, let alone their potential passage, is going to be felt for generations. It is truly painful to hear a movement that essentially at its core believes that being trans is wrong and should be eradicated.
And what are the kinds of policies that you would hope the Biden-Harris administration would pursue in terms of trans rights beyond just the issue of the military?
I mean, I think what we want to see, and of course, the first few days are examples of just rolling back what we already saw as the backward steps from the last administration. I think what we need to see is an aggressive enforcement, first and foremost, of federal civil rights laws. The states that are trying to attack trans students should be aware that they're putting their federal funding on the line, and we need the Biden-Harris administration to take an aggressive position to ensure that trans people are fully protected under the law. But also, we need to go much further than that. We know that civil rights protections on their own aren't going to save trans lives. We have people experiencing high rates of criminalization and homelessness. We need aggressive action from this administration to end deportations, to really have meaningful efforts to decarcerate, to end systems of policing that disproportionately harm our communities, to take, aggressive stances against bills like SESTA and FOSTA that criminalize sex work, that make it harder for people to survive, particularly for trans people of color, Black trans women in particular, who are repeatedly profiled and targeted as sex workers or perceived sex workers. So we need to hold this administration to account, not just to espouse, formalistic notions of equality, but really build out meaningful programs of justice. And that's going to take a lot more than what we've seen so far. Although I will say that the EO, at least, announcing that they will enforce Bostock, the Supreme Court decision, should have an impact on the states that are about to risk all their federal funding just to target trans young people.
Chase, can you talk about the move made by the new governor of Puerto Rico, who's declared a state of emergency over gender-based violence after a wave of killings targeting women and transgender people? Can you talk about the significance of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the greatest challenges, and particularly when we're looking at movements from a legal perspective, is how do we deal with the systemic violence that is affecting so many? And, you know, across the United States and in Puerto Rico, you know, we are seeing so many, you know, trans women and girls murdered. We're also obviously seeing so many cis women and girls murdered. And how do we deal with the fact that we have systems in place that allow for violence to continue, and yet the only solutions that we have tend to be carceral? And so I think having, you know, leaders, executives come in and say, this is an emergency. This is a public health emergency. This is an emergency of survival. And we have to come up with solutions that aren't just about sending people to prisons and jails, but are about looking at the roots of why people's bodies are so precariously situated that that it leads to mass death, whether that is at the hands of individuals, as we're seeing in the murders in Puerto Rico and across, you know, the world, and at the hands of the government, the sort of metaphorical hands of the government, because we set people up to be victims of violence, whether that's state violence or individually perpetrated violence. And so I think we need more recognition of the public health crisis of violence against women, cis and trans, and then systems in place that don't just rely on putting people in jail, but actually look at how we can, you know, distribute resources so people are actually experiencing safety and not just the illusion of safety that comes through carceral control.
Chase, thanks so much for being with us. Chase Strangio, Deputy Director for Transgender Justice with the ACLU's LGBT and HIV Project. Next up, as President Biden proposes a pathway to citizenship for 11 million undocumented immigrants, what should Biden do about the record number of people deported under the Obama-Biden years? We'll speak with journalist and author Jean Guerrero. Stay with us.
En ácido libre no me contiene este cuerpo, ni cuatro paredes pueden contener al viento. Solo con contar contigo, con eso tengo, libres de pensamiento, juntos en movimiento. Mi país me duele por su mal gobierno, una muerte tras otra, sin remordimiento. La impunidad siempre es el procedimiento, es hora de recuperar el poder desde acá adentro. Palabras dadas como balas de conocimiento, te darán un escarmiento, corre que apenas caliento. Sigue el mandato violento, matando a gente inocente, dile al presidente que seguimos de pie, con la vista al frente, a sangre ardiendo, con mi puño en alto, en las calles coreando, porque desde Tlatelolco hasta Ayotzinapa, ningún estudiante más borrarán del mapa.
Libre by Niña Dios. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. This week, immigrant rights activists launched a new campaign called We Are Home to push President Biden and Democratic majorities on Capitol Hill to create a pathway to citizenship for 11 million undocumented immigrants. Biden included the pathway to citizenship in a proposal he announced on his first day in office last week, along with six executive orders dealing with immigration. Politico now reports Congress may break the proposal into parts. Biden also ordered a pause on all U.S.-Mexico border wall construction, but billions of dollars of unfinished work remains under contract with the federal government. Activists in over a dozen U.S. cities held a day of action Sunday, urging him to take further steps to stop the construction. Meanwhile, Biden's 100-day deportation pause took effect Friday, and it's facing a challenge from Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, who argues an agreement the Trump administration signed in its final weeks with Arizona, Indiana, Louisiana, and Texas entitles them to a 180-day consultation period. Since Trump left office last week, his former senior advisor on immigration, Stephen Miller, has emerged as a right-wing media personality. He went on Fox News' The Ingram Angle Friday to attack Biden's immigration plan.
If you read the text of this order, it is breathtaking and mind-boggling in its scope. It halts all deportations for 100 days, including the most hardened criminals living in the United States. That means child molesters, sex offenders, drug dealers, gang members, MS-13, all shielded from removal. this is the priority of our new president?
Later this week, President Biden is expected to issue another executive order to restore asylum protections and set up a task force to reunify families separated at the border. For more on all of this, we're joined by Jean Guerrero, the investigative journalist who profiles Miller in her book, Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda. She just published an op-ed this past weekend in The New York Times that's headlined, 3 million people were deported under Obama. What will Biden do about it? Jean Guerrero, welcome back to Democracy Now! So talk about the executive orders that Biden is taking and what you want to see him do.
Right. So far, we've seen him reverse a lot of the actions that Trump took, you know, ending the Muslim ban, reviving DACA and, you know, stopping the border wall construction. But in many ways, his plan sort of goes back to policies and you know, approaches that we saw under the Obama-Biden administration. He talks about prioritizing serious criminals for deportation and maintaining family unity. This is something that we saw Obama professed that he was doing. He talked about targeting felons, not families. But as you mentioned, you know, under the Obama administration, we saw more than 3 million people deported. These are people who had families, jobs, and homes in the United States. And a majority of these people were, in fact, guilty of only immigration offenses, you know, crossing the border illegally. These were not, in fact, serious criminals. So if Biden merely reverts to the policies of the Obama administration, he's really ignoring the lessons of that era in which we learned that, you know, criminalizing certain immigrants or criminalizing immigration overall ends up fracturing and financially devastating immigrant communities as a whole. And so I argue that if Biden is serious about a more humane approach on immigration, what he needs is not just to reverse Trump's policies and go back to Obama-era policies. He needs to actually, you know, repair the harm that was done when he was vice president. And that is going to entail, you know, providing a pathway to reunification for a lot of these families that were fractured and separated by the mass deportations. He's promising to do this for the families that were separated at the border under Trump. You know, those separations caused a lot of outrage in America and created a sort of amnesia for what had happened under Obama. And I believe he needs to provide the same sort of pathway to reunification for some of these families, as well as the mental health services that he's promising for the trauma that was caused to the Trump separated families. The American Psychological Association says that the Obama mass deportations caused serious psychological harm to children in the same way that the Trump family separations did. And I think that Biden really needs to reckon with that. You know, he really needs to reckon with the mistakes that were made when he was vice president.
And Jean Guerrero, I wanted to ask you about Biden has said that he has a plan that would establish a $4 billion program to assist El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras in reducing the poverty, crime, and conditions that drive people to the U.S. But now, I haven't done the exact math, but I'm pretty sure that $4 billion doesn't even compare to the amount of money the United States in real dollars gave to the Central American governments during the civil wars back in the 80s in military aid. Do you think that that's a sufficient amount to be able to address some of the deep problems that exist that drive people to come to the United States?
No, it's certainly not enough, and especially if there's not, you know, accountability and transparency in how that money is spent. I think that so far, whenever there are conversations about providing aid to Central America, there's this huge gaping hole in the conversations coming out of Washington, D.C., which is, what about all of the, you know, as you were saying, the military aid that was provided over the past few decades that contributed in a major way to the violence that is sending people north seeking refuge in the United States? And not only that, but also, what about the fact that a majority of weapons that are seized at crime scenes in Mexico and other parts of Latin America come from the United States? And there's almost no conversation currently happening about the smuggling of weapons that contribute to the violence in Central America. And I think that's something that Biden also needs to do something about.
And in terms of the this whole issue of that, both a lot of Democrats and Republicans agree on the need to supposedly deport those who are undocumented or even the permanent residents who are felons or criminals. And you write about in your book about your bisabuelo, in a recent article, No Country for Brown Sinners, you wrote, quote, that your bisabuelo was one of the bad ones, not one of the model Mexicans you're supposed to care about, the ones whose stories some people cherry pick to tug at your heartstrings. What about this issue of people making mistakes, whether they're citizens or undocumented or permanent residents here in the United States?
Right. So this is very important because over the decades, we have had these very violent immigration policies and this militarization of the border based around the idea of the bad hombre. You know, for Obama, it was, quote unquote, felons, not families. For Trump, it was, you know, he was going after alleged criminals and rapists and bad hombres, not the good people that occasionally come across, according to him. So this story of the bad hombre has been weaponized over the decades to punish entire immigrant communities. You know, by contrasting the quote unquote bad hombre with the quote good immigrants who work unnaturally hard and never break any rules. Essentially, what politicians are doing is they're reducing immigrant lives to caricatures who can be exploited and expelled from the country. And so I think it's very important that we be very careful about the narratives that are being used both in the media as well as, you know, by politicians. I personally, you know, come from a lineage of so-called what would be considered quote-unquote bad hombres. You know, my father is an immigrant from Mexico who struggled with substance abuse, which is the subject of my first book, Across Border Memoir. And so for me, this is personal. My father is the type of non-white person who is devalued and dehumanized by immigration narratives and policies, whether it's Trump's bad hombres or Obama's quote-unquote felons, not families. And this is something that I noticed contributed to the apathy of people in regards to Obama's mass deportations. People thought, oh, well, these are bad guys. We don't, you know, most of these were you know, men, and people just kind of shrugged that they didn't have to be in the country. But I spoke to a lot of these people. I documented their skeletons in the border desert after they died trying to be reunited with children in the United States. These are men whose only crime was being in the United States illegally, having looked for a better life for their families. And so I think that Biden needs to be very careful about the narratives that he's using right now. He's sort of falling into that same trap where he's saying, you know, my immigration policy is about prioritizing serious criminals. But what that does is it sort of like marries the concept of immigration in the public imagination with the concept of criminality. And that is something that we as a country really need to walk away from, because it contributes to a lot of the hatred and the resurgence of white supremacy that I document in my book, Hate Monger, where people just begin to associate people who come here, whether they're refugees or asylum seekers or immigrants, they associate them with criminality. And that's simply not the case. Immigrants are less likely to commit crimes than native-born people, according to, you know, practically every study that has been done on this issue.
Jane, you write in your New York Times op-ed about how an immigrant from Guatemala, Lucia Kiech, attended the 2016 Democratic presidential primary debate with her five children, who had not seen their father since he was deported 3 years earlier under President Obama. She asked the candidates about their position on deportations and family reunification. This is what she said.
I want to ask you a question. I have a deep pain. Me and my children have a deep pain because my children's father was deported for not having a license. He was a hardworking man. What can you do to stop the deportations and reunite the families?
I will do everything that I can to unite your family, your children.
And I will do everything I can to pass laws that would bring families back together.
Jean Gonetto, you write in your New York Times op-ed, today the meaning of separated families has narrowed, with Biden's reunification task force focused on those separated by Trump. Lucia's family has been erased. Talk more about this and what needs to be done.
Exactly. You know, when I was reporting on these mass deportations, there really wasn't a lot of outrage in America. And I remember wondering what it was going to take to get Americans to object to the violence of our immigration policies. And we saw the outrage come about during the Trump administration when we had the zero tolerance policy and this policy of separating asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border. Obama separated families in the interior, families with roots, families with homes and jobs and children in the United States. So the profile of the victims was different. And what it made me realize is that most Americans care very deeply about inhumane immigration policies, but they care mostly when it involves victims that they see as innocent or as exceptional. So under the Trump administration, it was very hard for people to actually perceive the families that were victims of immigration policies as bad hombres, because we were seeing the profile of these people, mostly people, mothers and children coming from Central America and seeking refuge, fleeing death threats and extreme violence at home. And so it's sort of this double standard that we have. In the United States, we're conditioned to delight in white male misbehavior in our culture. Meanwhile, we're conditioned to see flawed brown or black men as, quote, animals or, quote, monsters or, quote, thugs or invaders. So this demonization of flawed non-white men contrasts with our cultural fetish for white male anti-heroes, which you see in, our movies like American Psycho or TV shows like, Breaking Bad. And I argue in my op-ed that until our national narratives afford immigrants, brown and black immigrants, the same license to err as white men, they will be dehumanized by our institutions. Stephen Miller, who I profiled in my book Hate Monger, grew up idolizing white anti-heroes like Martin Scorsese's mobsters and John Wayne's cowboys, meanwhile reading about immigrants described as monsters and beasts in white supremacist novels. So his white nationalist agenda is the natural outcome of a culture that glorifies bad white men and dehumanizes brown and black men. And so I think that double standard is in play here when you see, when I talk about the importance of Biden not merely reverting to Obama-era policies of saying that he's going to prioritize serious criminals, because, again, that just marries the concept of immigration and committing minor immigration offenses with, some kind of national security threat, which it is not.
Well, Jean, the long-term solution clearly is a new comprehensive immigration reform law. And at least Biden has put forth his plan that would include a path to citizenship for the 11 million undocumented within 8 years. That's considerably better than back in 2014 when they were talking about 10 years and that didn't get anywhere. I mean, 13 years. And before that, in 2006, they were talking about 10 years. What are the prospects that you see right now for that being able to be passed in Congress, especially given the reality that once those 11 million are able to become not only permanent residents, but citizens, politics in this country is going to be decisively change. So I'm wondering your sense of how many Republicans there would be right now in Congress to be able to agree to pass immigration reform.
Well, I think that, there's going to be very little Republican support for this bill, but it is a possibility that we'll see some Republicans revert to, the conversations that were being had in 2013 and 2014 when they were talking about, the importance of courting the Latino vote and embracing the Latino vote and diversifying the Republican Party and, campaigning in communities of color in ways that they never had before. This is, these are conversations that the Republican Party was having about the need to reform itself, several years ago, and completely took, a 180 when Trump and Stephen Miller came into power and decided to double down on courting, with the white working class, particularly the white male working class. And so I do think we may see a return to those conversations. And I think this is an extremely significant bill. You know, it would provide these 11 million undocumented people who contribute economically and in so many other ways to this country with a pathway to citizenship if they pass a background check and if they've paid taxes. One way that I think that it could go a lot farther than what has so far been proposed is, you know, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, she is planning to introduce this resolution that, you know, completely rejects the quid pro quo framing of previous immigration reform efforts. So instead of offering protections in exchange for increased militarization, it completely rejects that. And it says, you know, we need to dismantle the deportation machine completely and completely decriminalize immigration. Instead of deporting everyone here who is here illegally or who has committed a minor offense like driving without a license, like Lucy Akiak's husband, there will be scalable civil consequences. So, for example, you may have to pay a fine for committing an immigration offense. You may have to do community service. So it also provides a pathway to reunification for any families that have been separated by the U.S. government, regardless of who separated them, because this resolution is driven by a respect for human rights rather than political considerations. And I think that's one way in which the Biden administration can go a lot farther.
So much more to talk about, but we're going to have you back, Jean. Thanks so much for being with us. Jean Guerrero, investigative journalist, author of Hatemonger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump and the White Nationalist Agenda. And we'll link to your piece in The New York Times. 3 million people were deported under Obama. What will Biden do about it? Next up, the inequality virus. Stay with us. Freedom for Some by South African musician, anti-apartheid icon Jonas Gwangwa. He died over the weekend at the age of 83. This is Democracy Now!, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We look now at growing inequality during the pandemic. A new report finds the collective net worth of U.S. billionaires grew by more than $1.1 trillion during the pandemic. The Institute for Policy Studies and Americans for Tax Fairness said those gains could, quote, pay for all the relief for working families in the $1.9 trillion stimulus package President Biden has proposed, while leaving the nation's richest households no worse off than they were before COVID-19 hit. Meanwhile, a new report by Oxfam International shows it could take more than a decade for poor people to recover from the pandemic and urges governments to take urgent action and, quote, set concrete time-bound targets to reduce inequality. Democracy Now! Recently spoke with economist Derek Hamilton, who wrote one of the report's forewords.
What we should not be concerned about right now is austerity politic, some notion of deficit constraint.
For more, we're joined by Oxfam America Vice President Paul O'Brien. The new report, The Inequality Virus, bringing together a world torn apart by coronavirus through a fair, just and sustainable economy. Paul, welcome back to Democracy Now! Lay out what you found.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks for having me. Well, it's worrying. The last time we did this report, we tend to do it around Davos when the rich gather, and usually in fur coats. This time it's virtually. The last time it was bad, and it's gotten a lot worse. In every country that we looked at, inequality has gotten worse during the pandemic. And perhaps it's not surprising, but it is really worrying. So the richest 10 people, they ended up making $500 billion during the pandemic. The richest 1,000 got all the money that they lost from the pandemic back and got to the same level of wealth within 9 months. But at the same time, it has been disastrous for people on the wrong end of poverty. The reality of it was that most people on the planet Earth were one crisis away from going into deep poverty or extreme poverty. And that crisis happened. It happened in health terms. It happened in economic terms. It happened because they were locked down or they were forced to go out into precarious jobs. And so all around the world now, we are seeing folks struggling on the wrong end of inequality, while those who have been the beneficiaries of our broken economic system have done quite well.
And Paul, could you talk especially about the impact in the U.S. on African Americans and women in particular? You note that one in five Black women lost their jobs between February and April of 2020.
Yeah, well, let's talk about it in both health terms and in economic terms. In health terms, the really troubling fact is that this has disproportionately landed worst for Black and Latinx communities. If they had faced mortality rates at the same level as white communities, there would be 22,000 people alive today that are not. And a lot of it is because of how our economy is structured in terms of economic inequality. So if you're in the top quartile of income in the United States, you have a 90% chance of having paid sick leave. But if you're in the bottom quartile, less than half of you are going to get paid sick leave. You're out there as an essential worker or as a frontline worker, or you're often in the care economy, looking after kids or the vulnerable or the elderly. You can't do what I'm doing right now, which is to sit behind a desk, do your job and get paid. You have to be out there taking risks. So in both health terms and in economic terms, this has been a really rough for American workers. And we work alongside some of them. I'm happy to reflect some more personal stories if that's helpful.
So women have been particularly hard hit by the pandemic. Some have described this whole thing as a she session. During the month of December, women in the U.S. lost a net 156,000 jobs, while men gained 16,000 jobs, meaning women accounted for all the 140,000 net jobs lost. What this means, the setback for women in this country, decades, and what has to be done, and particularly around COVID, and who gets sick, who dies, who gets access to vaccines, not only in the U.S., but around the world?
Precisely, Amy. And the data around the world, I'm not sure it's even worse, but it is terrible in terms of how it has discriminatorily impacted women. A lot of it is because in the informal economy, you've seen 2 billion workers go out of work. Women are often on the front lines of undersecured labor. In the Middle East and North Africa, many of them have been forced to give up their jobs at 40% higher rates of job loss, even though they were already discriminated against to start with in terms of getting jobs. And we've seen this in Latin America and Sub-Saharan Africa, too. So without specific protections designed to make our economic system more gender just, to provide basic social protection, when you have a pandemic like this, it's going to hurt women more everywhere.
And the 10 richest men in the world, according to your report, have seen their combined wealth increase by $500 billion since the pandemic began?
Yep. And just to put that in context, that's enough to vaccinate everybody on the planet Earth to get rid of this pandemic. And that's just the profits they've made during the pandemic, the additional monies they've made. And of course, yes, it would be a good thing if they all sat around a dinner table and said, you know, we've made this extra money, we had enough to start with, let's get rid of this pandemic. But of course, our economic system can't rely exclusively on their largesse. What we are not doing is articulating and then passing the legislation that turns that from a voluntary philanthropic exercise into something they are required to do.
And what would that look like, Paul? We have 15 seconds.
Well, I wrote a book about it, so power switch. We've got a Biden and Harris administration that can't just normalize. They've got to pass a range of policies economically in terms of social protection that require corporations and the wealthy to pay their taxes and get that money into the system so that people have the social protection and economic opportunity they need to lift themselves from this pandemic.
Paul O'Brien, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Vice President of Oxfam America. We'll link to the new report, The Inequality Virus, Bringing Together a World Torn Apart by Coronavirus Through a Just, Fair, Sustainable Economy. A very happy belated birthday to Tarina Nadura. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love.